Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, broadcasting from Seattle, Washington. We have on the show today with us Dennis Wagner, the Executive Director of Access Research Network. We have Dennis on the show about this time of year each year to talk about a service that ARN, the Access Research Network, provides to the whole ID community. And that is they collate the top 10 Darwin Design science news stories of each year, and they release them on their website. The specific page, I believe, is arn.org/top10. And they basically help their readers remember and have a better understanding of all the scientific progress over the last year that has fallen in support and come down on the side of intelligent design. So, Dennis, thanks for coming on the show with us today.
It's my pleasure, Casey. I always look forward to this time of year.
Well, so do I, and not just because it's the holiday season and we get a few days off, but because this really is one of the most fun podcasts that I get to record every year. I probably say that every year when we record this podcast, but it really is interesting to look back at the year and realize just how much science has come down in support of intelligent design or challenging Darwinian evolution. And before we get into this too much, I want to just talk briefly about how your ARN top 10 stories has sort of evolved, so to speak, over the last few years. It's my understanding that in 2006, you guys started this, and at that time, it was sort of just the top 10 news stories and the top 10 resources, and now you are doing not just the top 10 news stories, but the top 10 science-focused stories, and then the top 10 sort of cultural-related stories, and then the top 10 resources as well. Is that an accurate summary of what you guys are doing?
Yeah, that's true. As we began tracking this, there just became so many stories that we thought were worthy of reporting at the end of the year that we couldn't just pick 10, so we broke it into the three different lists, as you talked about. The science news stories, which generally things published in science journals, I call them the cultural stories or the media stories, those things that impact our schools, our laws, jobs, persecution because of beliefs, those types of things. And then the resources, each year more and more resources have been published on intelligent design that we can make a whole list of 10. Don't have any problem filling that up each year.
Well, Dennis, this is a real service that Access Research Network provides to everybody, and I don't know how you narrow it down to 10 science stories. I mean, there are so many fascinating science stories that come out over the course of the year, and so many of them, increasingly more and more each year, I think, that are coming down in support of intelligent design. And so we can look forward in the next few weeks to maybe talking to you or other folks from ARN further about the top 10 cultural stories and also the top 10 resources. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, we're working on those right now. We wanted to get the top 10 science news stories out before the end of the year, so that's why we focused on that one first.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to whet our listeners' appetites for what will be coming. However, frankly, of the three top 10s that you guys do, the top 10 science stories are my personal favorites. So let's get into these a little bit, Dennis. We're going to start with some of the honorable mentions. An interesting honorable mention was automatic turnstiles in the cell. Obviously, the cell is full of molecular machines. What are these latest types of molecular machines that have been discovered that you guys reported about?
This is an ongoing theme in the intelligent design movement is basically looking at the cell as a factory and all the amazing machinery and mechanisms that we're discovering, complexities. In the cell, there's systems of transporters that transport nutrients into the cell and toxins out of the cell, and scientists have been studying these in more detail. And this year, in Nature magazine, there was an article published on the 21st of October that talked about one of these more elusive transporters that they hadn't really been able to understand. And through some X-ray technology that they use, they're able to find out that there's actually a little turnstile that goes on inside the cell membrane wall, these V-shaped cups that are made out of a collection of molecules. And this thing rotates like a turnstile. It can pump anywhere from 14 to 1,500 molecules out per minute through this turnstile. That's, you know, up to 25 times per second that this thing's spinning and kicking things out, and its speed actually varies to the size of the molecule that it's trying to take in or send out. So that was a pretty exciting discovery.
Now, the next honorable mention that you guys covered was Stephen Hawking's new book, The Grand Design. And this leads into a theme that I want to follow a little bit in our conversation. Last year, a couple of the major science stories that ARN discussed dealt with sort of overhyped claims from the evolutionary establishment, especially as they related to some alleged precursors to the human lineage in the fossil record, species like Ida or Ardi. We saw that those claims were really being overhyped in the media as far as what the evidence really showed for evolution. This year, we saw a lot of hype again, and Stephen Hawking's book, The Grand Design, really came out swinging, trying to claim that it had somehow removed the need for any intelligent first cause for the universe. I think Hawking essentially said that he had disproved the need for God. And, of course, Hawking's a smart guy, so people are inclined to believe his hype. But it actually turned out that the media is starting to get fed up with some of the hype. And we saw that in the response, the public response to Hawking's book, and that they were rejecting some of these bold and brash claims. So can you explain to us the story? What was Hawking arguing in his new book, The Grand Design? And what is this story, that the science story that played out in our culture this past year?
Well, you know, one of the headlines was that physics had finally made God redundant. Or, you know, that we had no more need for God now that Hawking's theories explained everything. And the physicists have been involved for a while in the search for the grand unifying theory, and Hawking's kind of moving in that direction with what he calls his M theory. The problem is M's yet to be determined. You know, is it master, is it miracle, or is it mirage? And Hawking tries to present this as we've got it all figured out. Basically, he's taken the ideas of quantum mechanics, which are observed in the subatomic world, and trying to extend those concepts to the universe and the formation of the universe. Well, we can't even extend those to our observable world, where Newtonian mechanics kind of rule the day. So it's really a leap of faith for him to take those principles from the subatomic world and say that this is, in fact, how the universe came to be. And so he was really beat up for that in an article in The Economist that reviewed his work and said that basically he's claiming that this is well-established science, and it is well-established science for the subatomic world, but it's just conjecture as far as how it applies to the principles of formation of the universe. So they said that his ideas are not testable and therefore are really outside the realm of science. And so here he is claiming that science has disproved God when, in fact, his theories, according to reviewers, can't even be categorized as science.
Well, and I don't have to be a physicist to know that something doesn't come from nothing. And it always has seemed to me that it's because Hawking is so brilliant that he's able to convince himself that something really can come from nothing.
Right.
Now, let's talk about a couple other honorable mentions, and these two kind of go together. One of them dealt with a story that we are more similar to Neanderthals at the genetic level, and another one dealt with a scientific paper that found that we are actually very different from chimps at the genetic level, especially when you study the Y chromosome. Can you enlighten us a little bit about these honorable mention stories?
Yeah, we put them in here because this really deals with the icon of human evolution that is kind of plastered in all our textbooks, with the primate-like animal kind of growing into the human being, and somewhere in there is the chimp and the Neanderthal, and as an icon or a picture, it is very powerful in its message. But when we look at the data, we find out that that doesn't stand up. And one of them was the thought that Neanderthal has long been portrayed as kind of a brutish, primitive, human-like form that was some intermediate ape-to-human transition. But what they're finding out now, they released some evidence in Nature News in April of this year that showed that there's actually some genetic evidence that there may have been breeding between the modern human form and the Neanderthals. And this goes along with a lot of other evidence that has been found recently, that they had language capabilities or artistic capabilities, other things like that. Basically, the view is changing now that Neanderthals were probably just another tribe living in the Stone Age and not some precursor to human, but actually just a different variation on the human species, if you will. And related to that is the chimp story that you talked about, where the argument there was that the DNA between the chimp and the human only differs by 1%. Therefore, we must have shared some common ancestor. But it was reported in January this year in Nature that actually they're discovering more and more differences in the DNA between the chimps and the humans. And the chimp Y chromosome they found only has 2/3 as many distinct genes or gene families as the human Y chromosome. So up to 30 or 40% difference in some of these areas, where before they were claiming it was just a 1% difference. So Again, the chimp to human icon of human evolution is not standing up to the evidence as we discover more from genetics.
Well, and I think that this was an interesting paper, especially because obviously we hear sort of this implied argument constantly that humans and chimps are so genetically similar that therefore we must share a common ancestor. I was recently in an email conversation with a PhD biologist who's an evolutionist, and we were talking about what in his view would falsify evolution. He said, well, what if we found that the human and chimp genomes were radically different? And those were basically the words he used. He thought that if they were radically different, that would falsify evolution. So I then sent him this Nature paper and quoted it where it said that the Y chromosomes in humans and chimps, quote, differ radically in gene content and sequence structure, unquote, and show, quote, extraordinary divergence where, quote, wholesale renovation is the paramount theme, unquote. Well, he didn't reply to that part of my email. So in any case, this is interesting research, and I think that this is the kind of stuff that makes some evolutionists lose a little bit of sleep at night, because it's very important to them that we are very close genetically to chimps. They really need that to be true.
Right.
The last honorable mention dealt with the primordial soup and whether or not it would have been an environment that actually would have had the chemical energy to produce life or to produce anything of interest. So can you tell us a little bit about this paper that came out earlier this year about the primordial soup?
Yeah, I like to introduce it as being similar to the soup Nazi episode from Seinfeld, where the guy behind those counters yelling, screaming, "No more soup for you." And that's basically the message out of this paper that came out in BioEssays in January and then also in the February Science Daily, where they said basically this 81-year-old theory of the primordial soup, it's time to retire it. And this is not really new news, which is why we stuck it in honorable mention, because the folks in the intelligent design community have been pointing out the problems with the primordial soup theory for years. But it's nice to see it finally come out in the science journals now. Other scientists are finally saying, yeah, the day is over for this particular theory. And they pointed out this was the theory that was proposed back in the 1920s by Haldane and Oprin, and then Stanley Miller did his famous experiments that everybody thought gave some experimental backing to this idea. But, you know, his experiment was done in a different environment, a reducing environment, which we don't see evidence for in the early atmosphere of the Earth. And we also have the problem that the same energy required to create those building blocks of life quickly destroy it unless you remove it from that environment. And so these articles bring out some of those same points and just say, look, this theory is dead. We realize that you're not going to get life from non-life from a warm little pond with UV radiation or lightning strike type thing. But what's really refreshing is to see that, you know, the authors are finally saying this is an icon of evolution that needs to be retired. Its time has passed and we need to move on to other ideas.
Well, Dennis, it just shows how far behind the starting blocks origin of life theorists are if they are still struggling to explain whether or not there could even have been a primordial soup. It just really shows the state of origin of life thinking, and I'm sure they will continue to push forward, and maybe in another 50 years they'll make some progress here. In any case, we're probably running out of time for this first podcast, but we'll come back for more with Dennis Wagner on the top 10 ARN Darwin and Design Science Stories of 2010. I'm Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.